Okay, we're beginning here with the Mishnah on the top of Yutet Amud Aleph. The Mishnah says, Omer Mishkali Alai, person who says that my weight I am dedicating as a nether to the Mikdash, notain Mishkalo, then he pays his weight to the Mikdash. Im Kesef, Kesef, if it's silver, it's silver. Im Zahav, Zahav, if it's gold, it's gold. The Gemara will discuss what that means. When is each one of them used? The Mishnah seems to be cryptic about this, and the Gemara will describe or try to understand what is being said in this first sentence of the Mishnah. Maseh bi'imah shel Yarmatya. There was an incident with the mother of Yarmatya. Maybe the word comes from hermit. She'amra mishkal biti alai. She took a neder to give the weight of her daughter to the Mikdash. Ve'alta Yerushalayim. She went up to Yerushalayim, shakla mishkala zahav, and gave the weight of her daughter in gold to the Mikdash. Sounds like here that this might have been a neder associated with the health of her daughter. And when the daughter recuperated or was found to be healthy after being ill, then she went up to Yerushalayim and gave the weight of her daughter to the Mikdash in Zahav. Mishkal Yadi Alai says the weight of my arm I am now obligated to give as a neder to the Mikdash. The problem, as Rashi notes over here, is that there's no way to weigh your arm, because you can control how much your arm weighs, because you can lean or put pressure on the scale, or you can lift it up and take weight off the scale. So there's no way to get an objective weight by simply putting your arm on the scale. So Rabbi Yehuda Omer, the best way to do this is memalei chavit maim. You fill a barrel full of water, umachniso ad marpeko, and then you stick the arm in until the marpek, and the water displacement gives you the volumetric size of the arm. Then you have to now figure out that displacement, how much does it weigh in terms of an arm, which we'll do in 1 second. The Mishnah will describe that. The Admar Peiko over here is controversial and has huge ramifications halachically. Rashi over here translates Mar Peiko as Atzil, which is the word that's used in many other places in Shas, sometimes with an Aleph, sometimes with an Ayin. Most of the Rishonim believe that those are interchangeable, the Aleph and the Ayin. There is one opinion, the Or Zeruah, who thinks that there's a difference between the Aleph and the Ayin, and that explains all the distinction here between the different interpretations. But Rashi says it's Atzio Shekorim Ishilia. Now, that Ishilia, based on what we see from Tosafot, means the Beit HaShechi, or the underarm. And you can see that more explicitly in the Rabbeinu Gershom, where he says, Ad Mepeko Ad Bet Shechio, until the armpit, Shehi HaKatef, which is the shoulder. So it's speaking about the joint of the shoulder. So according to Rashi and the Rabbeinu Gershom, you have to submerge your arm into this barrel to displace the water all the way up to your shoulder until the joint by the underarm. Tosafot over here brings Rashi's interpretation and says, Velo Nehira, it does not make sense. We're going to discuss in the second half of today's daf what Tosafot's position is and why he doesn't like what Rashi says. But Tosafot offers up the alternative that Marpeko is the Koda, which is the elbow. And therefore, he thinks that you only have to submerge your arm up to the elbow, and that's called the yad over here. Then you shokel mi basar chamor vatzamot vigidim. And then you weigh, through figure out the volumetric displacement, you use the flesh, the sinews, and the bones of donkey meat. And we'll see in the Gemara why this is used as the replacement. Venotein letocha ad shetitmalei. And then you submerge that meat into the barrel, and so you've now compensated for the displaced water that was caused by your submerging your arm into the barrel. Amar Rabbi Yosi, v'hiech efshar lekavein basar keneged basar, batzamot keneged atzamot. The problem that you have is that even if you can say that basar chamor, which the Gemara will say, is very similar to human flesh, you still have the problem of ratios, which is that an arm is comprised of bones, sinews, and basar. And the ratio between them obviously has influence over the weight. As Rashi says, the density of these items is different, and therefore the weight of these items is all different. So it might be that basar chamor matches up with basar of a person in terms of its density and its weight, but still doesn't mean that you're getting the right ratios of bone, basar, and sinews. And therefore, how does this work? Ella, shemina tayad, kamahi ru'uya lishkol. Rather, you used an estimate. You try to figure out, you try to estimate or give your best estimate as to what the arm weighs. And again, the Gemara will explicate in all of these matters. Now, the Gemara asks the question, my im kesef kesef, if it's silver, it's silver, im zahav, zahav. He didn't say anything. How do you know silver? How do you know when it's zahav? So, Amar Rabbi Yehuda, piresh. If he was explicit that it was kesef, I'm going to pay my weight in kesef, then he pays in kesef. Piresh zahav. He says explicitly, I'm going to give my weight in gold. Zahav. Then he gives it in gold. He says pshita. That's pretty straightforward. If that's what the mission is telling you, you don't need a mission to tell you that if you say something, you need to fulfill what you said. When it says dahakamash malan, that which comes out of this is taima de piresh. It's only because he was explicit about what was the mechanism of payment. Halo piresh. If he never gave an indication as to what is the payment mechanism for his weight, then patar nafshe b'chodu. He can use any item in order to pay. So if he specifies gold or he specifies silver, then he has to pay his weight in those currencies. But if he doesn't do that, then he can pay in anything that works as a weight currency, which we'll see in 1 second. Kirechava, dama rechava, ba'atra, the takle kufra, in a place where they sell pitch by weight, patar nafshe afilu b'kufra. You can even use pitch as the method of payment, the currency of payment. So you pay your weight in pitch, which obviously does not cost a lot in terms of its weight versus a precious metal like silver and gold. Where it says pshita, that seems obvious as well. If you use it for weight and you're allowed to use any currency, then why would you think otherwise? It says lo, tzricha de'ika de'takal ve'ika de'kayil. In this city, some people sell pitch by weight. Some, and maybe most people, sell it by measurement, by some sort of volumetric measure and not by weight. So madu teva came to kulo lo takle. Since not everybody sells it by weight, so then lo, you would not be able to use it as a currency. Kamash Malan, that as long as some people use it by weight, that is qualified to be used as the currency for the payment here of the weight of whatever you dedicated to the Mikdash. Amara Papa, Ba'atra de Takle Shamche, in a city where they sell onions by weight, Patanafshe Afilu Bisamche, you can even use onions for the currency of payment. Again, the Gemara says that's Pshita. Why would you think otherwise? Otzricha, the butter, the shakle, shadu. Here it's a question about the girsa, whether it's tray, plato, that after they weigh it out to give you what you asked for, they throw an additional 2 or 3 onions onto the pile. That's one way to read it. Or it could be tray, tilto. It's 2/3. Maudatema, I would have thought, batil torat mishkal. That will then undo what you did in terms of weight. Mashmalan, that it does not. So the way that Rashi explains this over here is that the person gives an additional bonus when he gives the buyer whatever weight that he's purchasing. So he purchases the weight, and then after that he puts on an additional amount on top of it. That additional amount makes it that the weight is no longer really the factor by which you're selling, because you're selling weight, but then you're adding something else on. So if that's the case, maybe they're really not selling by weight, they're selling by some form of estimation using a weight and then the additional items that they add on in the end. The Kamash Malan is that this is the normal way that people sell. And since this is the normal way that people sell, it does not undo the fact that it was weighed or this is sold by weight. That's how Rashi explains it. The Balei Tosafot don't love what Rashi is saying, is because they point out that the Gemara in Baba Batra, when we learned it, says that not only by onions, but by any sale, whenever it came to weighing items, the mocher has to always add on what's called hachra'ah, that he has to give a little more so it pushes the scale in favor of the buyer. That was a commercial practice in their time, that instead of giving the exact weight, you had to give the exact weight and then add a little more so that it looked favorable towards the buyer. So he says that's not just true by onions, that's true by anything. If that's the case, then this question should be applicable everywhere. So that's why Tosafot says, Yesh lamar dahachi peirush dahacha, Ba'atra de shaklu shade trade tilte yoter min achreya. This is above and beyond the normal amount that the commercial traders add on to push the weight in favor of the buyer. And in these situations or in these cases, they put on additional onions or additional weight, whether again that means 2 or 3 or 2/3 more of achreya that they put on top. So since they were doing that, you would think that maybe it undoes the fact that it's sold by weight. The Kamash Malan is that it's still classified as being sold by weight, and therefore you could use it as the currency for paying your weight to Hekdesh. Maseh b'imah shel Yarmatia. There was an incident with the mother of Yarmatia, which we saw in the Mishnah, where it says, Maseh listor. Looks like the incident comes to undermine what you said previously in the Mishnah. The way that we explained the first half of the Mishnah was that if you specify gold and silver, then you have to pay with gold and silver. If you don't specify, then you can give whatever you want. Then all of a sudden you bring a story that says she committed to give her weight to the Mikdash, and then she brought it in gold. So that's not an incident where she specified the currency, and yet she's bringing it in gold. That makes it sound like you have to bring it in gold, even if you never specified it. So that's what the Gemara wants to know, my silly store. Why are you bringing a case law down that seems to undermine what the Mishnah said until this point? It says, "Chesurei mechzera." The Mishnah is missing the transition within the Mishnah, which is Hachiktani. This is the transitional part of the Mishnah that's missing. V'im adam chashuvu. If it's a person of stature, afagav delo piresh, even if he didn't specify what he was going to give, lefik vodo, either amrinan or amdinan, we assess him based on what we think he would have said, or based on what would be appropriate for someone of this stature. And that's what the Mishnah proves from the case law, which is a masebi imashel yarmatia, shamra mishkal biti alai. She said, I'm going to give the weight of my daughter to the Mikdash, v'altala Yerushalayim, shaklua, they weighed her, v'natana mishkal azav, and she paid in gold. So even though she never specified gold as the currency, because this was a woman of means, they assumed, or they told her that that meant that if she took such a nether, then the currency for such payment should be in gold. So there is an additional factor here, which is when the default scenario where you don't specify the currency, anything that's measured by weight can be the currency that you use. But we have a test of reasonability on that, which is what is your economic ability to pay over here? And based on your economic ability, we'll say whether that item is worthy of your stature. Now, it could be that this is only applicable with people of high stature that they have to give gold. Or you could see it as a broader application to anyone who's coming up. We'll look at the currency they're using vis-a-vis the person's stature and economic capability to pay and say whether that's a reasonable assumption or is that not a reasonable assumption. Amar Rav Yehuda, Omer Komati Alai. He says, I'm going to give my height to the Mikdash. So obviously this is a play on our Mishnah. Our Mishnah speaks about weight. Weight is easy to measure, and it's also something that you can then take and compare with other items. So when you take another currency and pay your weight, it's very understandable. When you use height, it's hard to understand what he meant when he said, I'm going to give my height to the Mikdash. So Rav Yehuda explains, when you say such a thing, the noten shavit shenu nichfaf. He gives, whether it's a staff or a scepter, that doesn't have give in it. It's thick enough that it stands upright. Melokomati alai. On the other hand, if he says, my total height I'm giving, then he gives a staff or a scepter that has flexibility in it. So as Rashi notes over here, the difference between them is the thickness. When it's thicker, it has no flexibility and it stands upright and straight. That's the first case. In a case where it's thinner, then it will have flexibility in it and it won't stand as upright. You just have to give the length of your height, but it doesn't have to be so stiff that it's inflexible. And so therefore you can give something that is thinner. Obviously, even with this indication, it's still not clear exactly what you need to give. The Rabbeinu Gershom gives some flavor to explaining this, and he says that Kevin Damar Melo Komati Shehei Aruch Kimoti, so that it should be as long as me, Afilu Daka, even if it's very thin. On the other hand, if he says that it's Komati, then it's Davar Sheyochol Kayem Me'atzmo. It's something that could stand independently. So it doesn't bend over. So he explains the idea being that when you say my height is not only my height, but it means something that can stand at my height, which means it stands independently. Even without you holding it upright, it could stand upright. And so you need a certain amount of thickness that would give it that integrity. On the other hand, when you just say malokomati, it's just giving the total length of the item is the same as your height, but it does not suggest that it has to stand up or be upright like you are. And that explains the difference between them. Just note that the Rabbeinu Gershom later on, in the last line on the Amud here, says Ikadamre, and brings an Ikadamre that says just the opposite of what we have here. There was a Girsa that said that if it was Melo Komati, then you have to give something that's stiff and upright, thick. And if it's Komati, then you only have to give something that matches your height, but not something that can stand upright. And we'll see in a second why maybe that version makes a little more sense here in the Gemara. And the Gemara says over here, is that really true, what Rabbi Yehuda says? Because Meitave, we have a Braita that says, Komati alai, Melo Komati alai. Whether he uses either one of those languages, Notein Shavich and Unifaf, he gives a staff or a scepter that doesn't bend. So you see in the Braita, there's no differentiation between which language you use. And obviously that would undermine Rabbi Yehuda's position where he says there is a distinction between them. So who Omer ke Rabbi Akiva? He holds like Rabbi Akiva, the Daik Lishna Yetera. The Rabbi Akiva says that anytime you say something that's unnecessary, we have to give meaning to that unnecessary statement. It's somewhat akin to his Talmud, Rabbi Meir's position, which is Ein Adam Motzi Davar Levatala. We saw that by Nidarim and by commitments that you make, Rabbi Meir's of the opinion that people don't say things for naught. So it's of a similar concept. It makes sense. Rabbi Meir is the Talmud of Rabbi Akiva. So Rabbi Akiva says that over here with regards to extra language that you use. That's not. We have the Mishnah in Baba Batra. Lo et abor velo et adot. If a person sells his house, even though he writes with regards to the sale of the house that everything from the roof down to the ground or even into the depths of the ground are sold, not included in that sale is a bor and adot. They don't automatically go with the house. That is a cistern. A bor is a cistern that is not bricked up, but just dug into the ground. Whereas a dot is something that's bricked around and has a structure inside of that cistern or the ditch that's in the ground. So those are not sold with the house. Afapi shekatav, even though he wrote, omka viroma, the depths and the height, everything above the house, down to the bottom, even though he said that, it's not included. Tzarich likach lo derech, divrei Rabbi Akiva. The seller over here then has to get himself access to those items. Those items weren't sold, but since he sold everything, he also sold access to that, and now he's got to buy access from the person he sold it to. That's based on Rabbi Akiva's position that a mocher is mocher ba'ayin yafa. That a person, when he sells in the most generous manner. That means that he sells everything that he could, he sold, and he left behind the bor and the dot, because they're not included in a house sale, but on the other hand, he didn't leave himself access, and now he'll have to buy access to there. Chamim ormim, eino tzarich. You don't have to buy access to your bor v'dot, because you left that for yourself, because mocher is mocher ba'ayin ra'ah. Person sells in the most miserly fashion, and therefore you're going to keep for yourself whatever you need. That includes access to the bor and the dot. Umode Rabbi Akiva agrees, Bizman Shamar lo chutz me'elu, he says, I'm selling the house with the exception of the bor and the dot, she'ein tzarich klikach lo derech. Then he doesn't have to buy access. The reason being is, Alma kevin delo tzarich, since he didn't need to say it, vika amar, and he did say it, letfuye milta ka'ate. He's coming to add something additional on. That means in this case, if you'd sold the house without making any qualification of the sale, the bor and the dot would not have been sold. So then when you go out of your way to say, I'm selling the house without the bor and the dot, that's unnecessary. Even if you didn't say it would have been sold without it. So then when you said that, you must be adding on something that you want besides the bor and the dot. And that's what Rabbi Akiva says. You said something that was unnecessary. It is because you want to add on to keep for yourself the additional access routes to there. And then Rabbi Akiva will agree with the Chachamim that in that instance, he preserved for himself access to the bor and the dot. So when it says, Achanami, so to over here, that's what Rabbi Yehuda is saying, Kevin delo tzarich, since you don't need to say the extra language, vika amar, and he says it anyway, it's fuye milta ka'ate. It's coming to be additive in nature. So now, according to the way that we read the Gemara, it will turn out to be additive in a negative sense, which is that we said that if he says komati, he has to give a staff or a scepter that's thick and tall. And then if he says malokomati, he can something that's flexible, which means that the value goes down. He's giving less in that case. So then from komati to malokomati, where he doesn't need to say malo, komati would have done the job without it. So what we're saying here is the malo, the additional word, is adding something. Now it's adding not in the sense that it's adding and now he has to give more. It's adding in the sense that he's keeping more credit for himself or giving less. That's what you'd have to explain in our Gemara. But if you explain it based on the alternate Girsa brought by the Rabbeinu Gershom, then it actually flows much more smoothly, which is, he says that when you say komati, you can even give a flexible item. If you say malo komati, then you have to give something that can stand on its own. It's not flexible, that's thick. So then the malo is the additional language, and then you're after giving more. Let's fuye miltaati. It's coming to add something on. You're adding on that you have to give more in that case. So that's why that other Girsa of the Rabbeinu Gershom might make more sense over here. The Baliat Tosafot just point out that after we do this and explain Rabbi Akiva this way, then it's very hard to understand who's the author of the Braita. The Braita that we brought that says whether you say komati or malo komati, you give the same amount, which is you give an item that's inflexible. But who's the author of that? Even the Chachamim agree with Rabbi Yehuda that if you use extra language, then you get the benefit of that extra language. They're only arguing on a Rabbi Kiva over there about whether it's mocher b'ayin ra'a or b'ayin yafa. So they say you don't need the extra language to get the access roots because you get it without the extra language. But they're not disagreeing fundamentally with Rabbi Kiva that if you add language, that it has meaning. And over here, in this case, the addition of the language was unnecessary. And even the Chachamim would agree that there should be some differentiation. So then, if that's the case, who is the author of the Braita? The Bali Tosfot leave that as a Tzarech Iyun as to who is exactly the author. What you'll probably have to say is that the Chachamim might also disagree more fundamentally with Rabbi Kiva, and that change in language is not sufficient to force you to pay more or less, depending on which girsa you have over here. So now the Gemara moves on to a series of questions that are difficult to understand. We have different views within the Rishonim as to what is meant over here. The first question is, Ibailuhu, Omdi Mahu, my standing up, what is the din? So now the Rabbeinu Gershom gives the simplest explanation over here as to what the Gemara's question is. And that's all you can find in the last couple words on the Amud here, which is, Yesh v'lo zon hazeh lashon neder? Olo, is this considered to be a neder, or is this not considered to be a neder? Is he just speaking nonsense? Or do we equate omdi with komati? My standing up is the same as saying my height. So that's the question here. Is this a neder, or is this just gibberish because it has no meaning in this context? That's the simple way to read it. That's the Rabbeinu Gershom. Rashi, on the other hand, says that omdi, the question is that considered to be this equivalent of komati, or is that considered to be the equivalent of melo komati? Does standing up mean a sharvit komato, that is his height, or that is not his height, whether that means it's not his height and it's flexible, or it's meaning something else over here? The truth is that in all these instances, if we could ask him for what he meant, and he tells us what he meant, then in all likelihood we would assume that that's what he meant, and that would be the nether, or he'd have to fulfill the nether. In that case, it would be clear. Generally, these questions, as the Gemara puts them, is a case where he said it, and he says, I don't know. I just assumed that whatever the Chachamim told me, that's what I'm going to do. Question is, what are the Chachamim going to tell him in this case? When he uses such a language, what does that mean, or what is the proper resolution to that language when he says Omdi? Now, for the Rabbeinu Gershom, it's more fundamental than that. It's a question of whether he took a neder at all. And that's what the question is by all of these issues, is that did he say something reasonable or did he say something that was meaningful? So that question would be, even if we know what he was trying to say, it just may be that he just didn't articulate it properly because he used language that doesn't make sense. But for the Rashi and the Bali Tosafot to think that the questions here are more about the minutia of what is meant by this item, then you have to say that either he doesn't remember or doesn't know what he meant to say, or he said, whatever the Chachamim tell me, that's what I'm going to do. So now, the Rochbo Mahu, my width, what is the story with that? So Rashi says, my width means, does that mean a Sharvit, that is Rochav, Dugmati? Does that mean that it is basically, from my understanding of Rashi, means that it's a staff that is as tall as he is? Question is the width of that staff. Does that now mean Rochbo means that it's a staff that is as wide as I am? And it doesn't give the height, but I guess the assumption would be the height is his height. Or does Rochbo mean that I want to give a staff that is as long as my width? The length of the staff, not the width of the staff, is my width. So that's the other possibility of Rochbo. Then he says, Ovyo Mahu, my thickness, what is the din? So Rashi again says, you're speaking about a Sharvit. And what is the meaning of Ovyo over here? Does the Ovi mean height of the Sharvit is your height, and then your thickness is what is meant by the thickness of the Sharvit. So whatever you are, maybe from front to back, that would be the thickness of the Sharvit. Or does Ovyo mean simply the length of the Sharvit is my depth? And so that would be the length of it, and it would be a much shorter Sharvit. And then the last one is Hekefo Mahu. When he's speaking about Hekef, he's speaking about the circumference of the individual. So are you speaking about a Sharvit that basically is like a cylinder or something that is as rounded in size as the individual, the circumference of the individual? Or you're speaking about a Sharvit that is the length of the circumference of the individual? That's how Rashi phrases all the questions, and the Gemara leaves it as a teiku, as an unresolved issue. Interesting enough, the Rambam says with regards to the teiku over here, you take the person and say, all right, is that you're going to have to pay this amount. And he says, okay. Then we say, wait, no, you have to pay more. And you keep going up in number until the guy says, there's no way I would have dedicated that much. It's just way beyond what I was thinking. So that's how you deal with the teiku, is that you try to figure out how much the person would have reasonably paid, and we assume that that's the Chumrah. If it turns out to be his inheritors that are paying on his behalf over there, then we go to Kula, and we take the lowest common denominator. And the Achronim try to understand why the Rambam differentiates, either because Amotzi Mechaveru of Araya is what we deal with regards to the Yorshim, but with regards to the individual who's trying to discourage his obligation vis-a-vis the Neder, he's got to go as far as possible because the Neder is always Lachmir, or we have to make sure that he is accomplishing what he said in his Neder. So that's the view of Rashi. On the other hand, if you look in the Balei Tosafot, the Balei Tosafot say that the structure of the Gemara here is Faresh Kol Habayot Be'imtim Salomar. All of these questions are if you then said, which means that there's a chain-linked questions over here. Rashi sees each question as being independent, similar genre, but each one being independent. The Tosafot says that each one of them is chain-linked to the other one. And therefore he brings, the first case is, if you say Omdi, what does he mean by Omdi? Does he have to give a Shavit that can stand on its own? Or do you have to give a Shavit that can be flexible? Then the Gemara says, Imtim Salomar, Damod, or Omdi, means that you have to give something, a Shavit, Shenichvaf, that can't bend over, then Biruchbo Mahu. What's the din Biruchbo? Does that mean Kiruchbo Mamash, which means exactly like his width, and that means it has to be a Shavit that cannot be flexible? Or when he says Ruchbo, does he mean something that is as long as his width? And then the Gemara says, Imtim Salomar, Biruchbo Notain Shavit Kafuf. Then in a case where it's Ruchbo, you can give a flexible Shavit, then Yeshivati Mahu. And he has the additional girso over here, which you can see in the Ot Aleph of the Shita Mikubetzet, that they have this additional girso of Yeshivati. When I'm seated, what does that mean? Question is, when I'm seated, does that mean my height while I am seated? Or does that seated mean from my feet until my head, even though I'm in a seated position? And then at the way bottom, the Balei Tosafot bring from the Rabbeinu Elchanan, that Yeshivato, the question is, Mirosho ve'ad makom Yeshivato kamar? Does he mean from his head to where he is seated? Or does he mean kol gufo? Does he mean of all of his body? Sheyoshev mirosho ve'ad raglav, because he's seated from top to bottom. And then Tosafot brings the other possibility of Yeshivato, which is mi amrinan sheretzon lomar sheitena shavit shemachzik komat Yeshivato. It has to be up to the height of his seated. Below kumelo komat amidato. Not like when he's standing upright, where it would be much higher. Or dilma shavit shemachzik mikom Yeshivato kamar. What does it mean? A shavit that takes up the place where he is sitting. It takes up the area of where he is seated. And then, v'imtim salamar, the yeshivato, being seated, mashma, shavit kafuf, still means something that is bent, because when you're seated, you're bent over, and therefore it would indicate something that is bent. Then, what is it meant by ovyo mahu? What is meant by ovyo? And then, if you say imtim salamar b'ovyo, mashma b'kfifa, also means to be bent, then what's the din b'hekefo? That's the way that the Balei Tosafot read it. They really think that it all has to do with the original question of whether you have to give a staff that is flexible or inflexible. And each one of these is an Imtim Salomar based on either the positioning of the individual or the statement, what does it mean? And if you come to a conclusion, then we move on to the next question. According to Rashi and Tosafot, it's a question of how much you pay, not whether you pay or not. According to Beinu Gershom, it's a question as to whether you do pay or you don't pay. Mishkal Yadi Alai, my weight of my arm, I am committed now to give to the Mikdash. Tan Rabbanan, Mishkal Yadi u'Mishkal Ragli. He says, weight of my arm, the weight of my leg. Alai, I'm obligated to give. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Mevi Chavit u'Memalei Mayim. He takes a barrel, fills it up with water, u'Machnis Biyad Ad Atzil. And he puts his arm in until the Atzil. So this is, again, whether you spell it with an Aleph or an Ayin, we discussed before, so that's the possibility in the gears here. But this is the same thing that's mentioned in the Mishnah of Marpeko. It's a Rashi, and the Mishnah already said that Marpeko means Atzilo. And then you have to translate what Atzilo is, which we already noted before. According to Rashi, means up until your shoulder, until your underarm. And Tosafot says Ad Marpeko means until your coda, until your elbow. So that's how far you submerge it. Uberegel Adar Koba. And then for the leg, you put it in up until your knee. That's one of Tosafot's proofs that in all likelihood by the arm, you're speaking about the elbow, because by the leg, you're putting it up to the knee. So the knee and the elbow are similar joints, and therefore it would make sense that you're speaking about an elbow and not about the shoulder joint. Bishokel basar chamor vidim ve'atzamot. Then you weigh the flesh of a donkey, including the sinews and the bones. Then you place it inside until the water now surfaces back to the top. So that's the volumetric displacement that was caused by your arm. And you replace it with this flesh of the chamor. Because, again, we say that the flesh of the chamor is very similar to the flesh of human beings. Even though we don't have evidence of that, there is a mention of it that hints at this, asher basar chamorim bisaram, that their flesh is like the flesh of donkeys. Over there, it happens to be not speaking about Bnei Israel, it happens to be speaking about non-Jews. In addition, it's only speaking of basar, it doesn't speak about the atzamot and gidim. So it's a good zecher ledavar, but it's not an absolute proof to what we're saying. The Rabbeinu Elchanan over here also asks, why do you have to weigh the meat before you put it into the water? You're weighing the meat of the basar chamor, and then you put it in the water. That's a little strange. Don't you need to know how much you are weighing, how much you need to put in volumetrically, and then weigh it afterwards? So why are you weighing it first and then putting it in to reach the volumetric level? He says simply that it's lav dafka. It doesn't mean you weigh it first and then you put it in, but rather you put it in and then you weigh it afterwards. It's not dafka in terms of its order. Then Re says that it's dafka in this order. And that is because if you did it in the other way around, you'd actually end up with a problem, which is that when you put the basar chamor into the water, it becomes waterlogged and now weighs more. So if you were to put it in first to figure out the volume and then weight it afterwards, you'd actually get too much weight because you'd include the water in that weight, which you don't want to do. That's why you have to weigh it first and then slowly put in piece by piece until you reach the volumetric level that levels the water back to where it was before at the top of the barrel. So the reclaim said it's actually dafka and not lav dafka, that you're weighing it before you submerge it. And the Gemara says, Amalei Rav Yossi, Heyach efshar lekavein basar keneged basar, gidim keneged gidim, atzamot keneged atzamot. So okay, even if you think the basar chamor and all of its component parts are similar to a human weight, the density of these items and the weight of these items is the same, nevertheless, how do you know you're going to get the right ratios? The arm is comprised of all three of these items, and how are you going to make sure to get the right ratio of bone to sinew to flesh? Because they all weigh different amounts, and then obviously that's going to skew it. So Amalei Rav Yehuda, Omdim, we estimate. We try to figure out what the ratios are. So Amalei Rav Yossi, Ad She Omdim, Yimodu Et Hayad. If you're going to estimate already, you may as well estimate the whole thing. Why bother to do all this when you could just estimate? So Rav Yehuda responds to him and says, Rav Yehuda Kama Defshar Avdinan, as much as we can do, we do. So, seemingly, the machloka between them is, Rabbi Yehuda says, let us do as much measuring that we can do as possible. And whatever we have to estimate, we'll estimate. But at least we have some sort of measure that's working out over here. I think Rabbi Yossi's claim is, how could you go about doing something with such precision, but in the end, the precision has no bearing? You're putting the arm in, trying to figure out the volumetric displacement, and then, in the end, it's all an estimate of what you're going to put in terms of how much basar, gidim, and atzamot of the basar chamor. And that's going to be as influential, if not more influential, than the precision measure of the displacement of the water. If that's the case, then why bother doing all of that precision measurement when the whole thing comes down to an estimate anyway? So then just estimate the whole thing, and that's your best way to go about it. Rabbi Yehuda, I think, is saying that you want to get some benchmark. It may not be perfect, but at least here, if you get some volumetric displacement, then at least you have some sense of what should be, or the benchmark levels that you were looking for. And that would help you. Even though you have to estimate some of it, at least this gives us some indication of what we're supposed to do. And that's the machloket here between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Yossi. Now the Gemara says, Biyad ad atzil. Is it really true that the hand or the yad is considered until the atzil? Again, for Rashi, that means until the shoulder. For Tosafot, means until the elbow. Biraminu, is that really true? Kiddush yadayim raglayim b'migdash ad perek. Washing one's hands and feet in the migdash is done until perek, until the joint. So the Gemara's answer is, Doraita Ada Perek. You're right. Mina Torah, the Yad is only until the joint. Binadarim Alich Achar Lashon Bnei Adam. By Nadarim, you go after the way that people speak. So even though the hand in Torah language and Kiddush Yadayim Raglayim means until the wrist, so that's where you have to do Kiddush Yadayim Raglayim up until the wrist. And then when it says that the Yad over here means until either the shoulder for Rashi or to the elbow according to Tosafot, that's the way that people call a yad. That's what they call in the colloquial, the vernacular, that's what they call a yad, is up until that point. And that's why you measure it here, because then leather is determined by Lashon B'nai Adam. Where it says, Udu Araita Ad HaPerek, are you so sure That means d'oraita, the yad only goes up until the wrist. V'ha gabei tefillin, dichtiv yadcha. It says by tefillin that you have to put them on, k'shatam neota yadcha, that you have to put them on your hand. V'tanet b'nei me'ashe, yadcha zo kiborit. That yadcha means the mass of muscle. So this actually leads to a machloket as to where the placement of the tefillin is, because kiboret, as Rashi translates over here, and Tosafot backs that up, is that kiboret means a mass of muscle. So there are two locations where you have a mass of muscle along your arm. One is the forearm, and the other one is the bicep. So the question is, do you put the tefillin on the forearm, or do you put the tefillin on the bicep? Tosafot claims that those people that say they put it on the forearm, which seems to be that there was a group of individuals, or even maybe Rishonim, that believe that you put it on the forearm, that they are making a mistake because the arm is comprised of two bones, and the bone that is from the wrist until the elbow is called the kaneh, and the bone from the elbow till the shoulder is called the zroah. And the Gemara says that the tefillin, and he brings many midrashim and other places that say that the tefillin go on the zroah. And so therefore, it has to be that the kibor that we're speaking about here is the bicep and not the forearm, because it's placed on the zroah and not on the kaneh. That's Tosafot's argument as to where the placement of the tefillin is based on this. But just know that there was an alternate view that it went on the forearm and not on the bicep. But what you see from here is that the word yadcha has a much more expansive definition than we would have thought. Just before you said it was all until the wrist is called the yad. Now you're saying the yad is basically all the way up to the kiboret. So the Gemara says, okay, d'oraita kiboret kula. The midoraita yadcha means all the way up until the bicep, but with nidarim, halei chachar l'shom b'nei adam, by the nidarim, you go by l'shom b'nei adam. So for Rashi, that means you go higher than the bicep, all the way up to the shoulder. But those means you go lower than the bicep, you go to the elbow. But then, what about the fact that we said before, the kiddush yadayim raglayim were ad haperek? That's also about yadayim. So the kiddush yadayim raglayim v'mikdash hilchata gemirla. That's a halacha l'moshe misinai. That's a misora that it only goes up until the perek. It only goes up until the wrist. Now, this also has huge ramifications, the halacha. This whole machlok between Rashi and the Bali Tosafot as to whether here it means until the shoulder or until the elbow has implications, because the Gemara in Chulin brings down a braita that tells us that when it comes to washing one's hands, there are three different areas where you wash until. For Chulin, ad haperek. Litruma, ad haperek. Lekidush yadayim raglayim ad haperek. So then the question is, the Gemara uses this term perek, which means a joint, and it uses the term perek in all three of them. And the question is, what three prakim, what three joints are you speaking about? Now Tosafot's proof as to what three joints you're speaking about comes from the Gemara over here, because the Gemara over here says that until the elbow is lashon b'nei adam, and then kidush yadayim raglayim is halacha l'moshe misinai, that it goes until the perek, which is the wrist. So then, if you look at that Gemara in Chulin, that gives you the three locations of Netilat Yadayim, you have to be at three different joints, and the last of those joints is the wrist. That means Kiddush Yadayim Raglayim in the Mikdash is until the wrist. That means Kiddush Yadayim Raglayim for Truma is until the knuckles. And then Kiddush Yadayim Raglayim for Chulin is until your first knuckle joints, meaning the tips of the fingers, as Tosafot says, from the thumb, the same joint in the thumb. The thumb has one joint, whereas the other fingers have two joints. So it's from the second joint, which is the same one that the thumb has. That's where you have to wash for chulin. For truma, you have to wash up until your knuckles, where the fingers attach to the hand. And then for kiddush yadayim raglayim, you go up until the wrist. That is the view of the Bali Tosafot. The Bali Tosafot there in chulin bring an alternate opinion of Rabbi Avram. Rabbi Avram says that the three prakim that we're speaking about here are the knuckles, which is for chulin, you wash up until the knuckles. For truma, you wash up until the wrist. And for kiddush yadayim raglayim, you wash up until the elbow. Now, Tosafot has good reason to say that that's not the case, because then over here, the Gemara doesn't make any sense. Because over here in the Gemara, it says that up until the elbow is for nidarim. But for kiddush yadayim raglayim, it's halacha l'moshe misinai haperek. So that means it's different than the elbow. But if you learn like Rashi over here, that it means until beit hashechi, means until the shoulder, then you can make sense out of it. Because over here, if the Gemara is saying that the halacha lechayar leshon b'nei adam means all the way until the shoulder, kiboret is for tefillin, and halacha moshe misinai takes the kiddush yadayim raglayim to the elbow. And that means that kiddush yadayim raglayim is till the elbow. That means for truma until the wrist, That means for Chulin until the knuckles. Why does that matter? It matters because the Gemara in Chulin at some point brings a daya that for Chulin and Truma the din is the same, and that we paskin that way. That means that for washing Yadayim today, our Netilat Yadayim, we wash like you would wash for Truma. Well, that makes a difference now. Where do you think that point is for Truma? According to the Bali Tosafot and Rashi in Chulin, the point is until the knuckles, where the fingers attached to the hand, that's where you have to wash until. On the other hand, for the way that the Rabbi Avram explains it, then the washing point is all the way until the wrist for Truma, and that's where you'd have to wash for Chulin, all the way up until the wrist. So this turns out to be a major machloket in the Rishonim. The Rif, the Rabbeinu Hananel, the Rashba, the Rambam is not clear at all. All say that the washing for Netilat Yadayim needs to be done until the wrist. Rashi, the Balei Tosafot, and many of the other Rishonim believe that it's only until the knuckles, until the point where the fingers attach to the hand. That's where the Netilat Yadayim goes up to. So then, halachically, the Beit Yosef makes a statement, which is very true. He says, my nafkamina. Why does it matter? For a little more water, you can be Yotzei L'chol HaDeot, and why not just wash up until the wrist? And that's how the Beit Yosef paskins, and he brings it down in Shulchan Aruch, that one should wash up until your wrist. Even though he says there's a daya that you only have to wash until the fingers attached to the hand, until the knuckles. But nevertheless, he says that for a little extra effort, why not wash until the wrist? But it still has halachic nafkamina, even though we say that. The two areas where it has halachic nafkamina is one is where you don't have sufficient water. You don't have enough water to wash your whole hand, but only up until the knuckles. Is that enough? And the answer would be, according to many Rishonim, yes. The other place in halacha where it has a nafkamina is on Yom HaKippurim and on Tisha B'Av. On Yom Kippur and Tisha B'Av, where there's an Isser Rechitza, then you're allowed to wash your hands for dirt and to clear dirt off of your hands. The Isser Rechitza in both of those places is an Isser Rechitza Shel Hana'a, where you're getting benefit or enjoyment from the washing. But if it's washing to remove tit or dirt from your hands, then it's mutar. So similarly, if you have to wash on Yom Kippur or on Tisha B'Av because you went to the bathroom, you relieved yourself, or because you woke up in the morning, you have to wash Negelwasser, that's the equivalent of, call it spiritual dirt, or maybe even real dirt when you're speaking about washing your hands from after relieving oneself, you're allowed to wash it on Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur because it's a rechitza shesholo lehana. But that's only true up until the point that you're obligated to wash. If you go beyond the point where you're obligated to wash, that already becomes a rechitza shel hana'a rather than a rechitza that is mutar. And so therefore, we on Tisha B'Av and on Yom Kippur are machmir for the shita, the Rishonim, that say that you only have to wash until the knuckles and not until the wrist. And so therefore, that's what we do. Our practice is because there's a day of the hakel. We can't just say like the Beit Yosef, why not just be machmir? It's no big deal. Yeah, it's no big deal every other time of the year. But on Yom Kippur and Tisha B'Av, it is a big deal because there's an Issur Rechitza. And so therefore we paskin that you only wash up until your knuckles on those particular days, even though the Rabbeinu Tam makes the suggestion that any type of washing for Ruach Ra and that type of thing is all considered to be washing of dirt. Maybe if you went up to your wrist, it would be okay because your intent is for that and not for Hana'a. But the way that we paskin is that you only wash until your knuckles on that day. I sent out pictures to demonstrate all these different opinions, as well as the Mikorot, so that you can see what was discussed here. But our Gemara here is a major nafkamina in this, because Tosafot uses our Gemara from two positions here to show that the atzil must mean the elbow over here, both because the meaning of the word atzil is matched up with our kuba in the leg, which is the knee and the elbow. Another proof of the Balei Tosafot is the fact that it says in Yechezkel v'yachgor otam v'yaza with regards to the avnet of the Kohen, that they put him in a place where you do not sweat. And we saw before in the Gemara that the avnet is keneged alev. Now, according to the way that Rashi is explaining it, that it's by the Beit HaShechi, Tosafot says that is a place where you sweat. Any place where you have skin over skin, that's a place of sweat, your underarms, and lower down on your loin, where the skin would fold over, those are both places of sweat. If you explain Marpeko or Atzil as elbows, then if you tie it near the elbows, that's in a place where there's no overlapping skin, and therefore it's a place that's not sweating. Even though Keneged Alev for Rashi makes more sense, because if you tied it under the arms, it really would be Keneged Alev. Tosafot says he thinks that this favors him because it's an area where you do not sweat, as opposed to the Beit HaShechi where you do sweat. As well as the fact that the Kiddush Yadayim Raglayim is contrasted with the Atzil. And Tosafot believes that seal is the elbow, then that has influence on where you think Kiddush Yadayim Raglayim is up until, where he thinks it's only up to the wrist, as opposed to those who would say here the marpeko or atzio is up to the beit hashechi, up to the shoulder, then the kishudem reglaim would be up until the elbow. So now, continuing in the Gemara here, now the Gemara says the same thing with regards to the arkuba, which is beregel ad arkuba. Is it really true on the leg up until the knee? Biramini regalim, but it says by the shlosh regalim, this is the obligation to go up to the mikdash on the shlosh regalim. It says regalim prat lebalei kabin. That is to exclude someone who has a prosthetic foot that they do not go up or they're not chayav to do aliyah leregel. So the Gemara says bidnedarim alecha hagar l'shom bnei adam. For the neder over here with regards to giving your leg, the colloquial meaning of leg means up until the knee. But the oraita, it's prat lebalei kabin. That means to exclude a prosthetic. According to the Torah, regel is only the foot, not all the way up until the knee. The Gemara says, is that really true? V'agami chalitza dichtiv raglo. It says there that she has to be v'chalto yal raglo, that she has to take the shoe off of his leg. V'tana chalta min erakuba ulamata chalitza tak shira. If she takes it off from the below, knee and below, that's considered to be a good chalitza. So that means that midoraita, the leg is considered all the way up to the knee. Rashi claims over here is that even if he's missing his foot or missing his leg, as long as he has any piece of his leg below the knee, then they can perform chalitza. That's the way Rashi explains it, and it makes sense in the context of our Gemara over here. The Baal Tosafot point out that in the Gemara, in Yevamot, as well as in Yushami, it's very clear that if you don't have a foot, you can't do chalitza. And so it doesn't make any sense what Rashi's saying. And so Tosafot says it has to do with where it's tied. The sandal that the man is wearing, up until where is it tied? If it's tied on his regel, then her releasing of the tying of the shoe is considered a chalitza if it's on his leg. But if it's above his leg, then it's not considered to be chalitza. And so if it's tied below his knee, then that would be a chalitza. If it's tied above his knee, that would not be a chalitza. That's the way the Baal Tosafot would explain it. But now we're in a bind, because even in a Torah, it sounds like raglo goes all the way up until the knee. Where it says, shiny hotam, there it's different by chalitza, because it says, damakra mi'al raglo. Because it says there that she'll take it off of his foot. Mi'al raglo. Even above his foot. Not just the regel, but mi'al raglo. Even above the foot. Iochi. If that's the case, efilu l'malo, mi'al kuba nami. Why can't you then go above the knee? If it means mi'al raglo, means above his foot. It can be anywhere above his foot. Where it says, mi'al, velo mi'al de mi'al. It means only above his foot, but not above his foot. So meaning that you go one step above the foot, which would be the calf, and not all the way up to the thigh, because that would be the thigh, which is above the calf, which is above the foot. And that doesn't work. So you can only go up one extra stage above the foot. So Amar Papa Shmamina, Hayis Devira, your ankle, Ad Ara Nochit, must reach until the ground. Disak Adatcha Mifsak Pusik, if you think that the bone that comprises the ankle is not one with the heel of the foot, then havelei istavira me'al, then the regel would be a reference to the foot itself, including the heel bone. The ankle would be the item that sits on top of the heel, or on top of the regel. And then v'shaka, then the calf, me'al de me'al, would then be two removed, and then it would not be kasher. The fact that the Gemara over here is telling us that the calf is kasher for chalitza tells you that the ankle and the heel must be a single entity over here. And the Gemara says, Rav Asher Amar, afilu teima mifsak pasik, even if there is a break between the ankle and the heel, kol debahadi kara kikara damu. Anything that's along the plane of the foot is classified as the foot and not being above the foot. So this actually has, again, here, nafkamina to halacha, not necessarily over here where the Gemara is discussing it, where it does have some nafkamina, but I'll explain to you in a second why there are other areas of halacha where it has implications. What the Gemara here is discussing is that you have in the structure of the foot, you have the foot itself, and then you have the ankle, which is comprised of two or three bones, and then you have the calf above that, which is like the fibula and the tibia, which are the bones that comprise the area from between the ankle until the knee. So the Gemara is saying when it comes to the ankle, it must be that the ankle is fused together with the heel, because otherwise then the regel would end before the ankle, and the ankle would be the bone that sits on top. That's what Rav Papa says. Rav Ashi says that maybe that's not true, because even though the bones are separate and the ankle is separate from the heel, nevertheless, the ankle is on the plane or part of the structure of the foot, which is at the point where already the bone structure turns towards being the foot. And so therefore the ankle is considered to be a part of the foot, even though it's a separate bone. Now why this has big nafkaminot is because the Gemara in Menachot, on Daf Lamed Gimel, has a din with regards to mezuzah that you had to put up a mezuzah kistavira. Over there, the Rishonim argue about what the istavira is. It's because the Gemara says, with regards to a mezuzah, if you put it up like a lock, it is pasul. If you put it up like an istavira, then it is kasher, because in the house of Rabbi, they used to put it up like an istavira. Now the question is, what is an istavira? Does that mean the ankle upright? Does that mean the ankle on the horizontal? Does that mean the ankle bone that's on the diagonal? Or does it mean like an L shape? So all of those will have nafkamina as to what is the proper placement or way to put up a mezuzah, depending on what you think the estavira is. Part of that confusion or part of the argument amongst the Rishonim over there is which bone of the ankle structure are we speaking about? Because you have the fibula, the tibia, then you have the ankle bones, and then it goes into the foot. Those ankle bones are comprised of 3, 4, 5 bones that create the joint and the change in direction from the vertical part of the calf to the horizontal part of the foot. And the explanation here of what istavir is would have influence over there as to which way would be a kosher way to put up a mezuzah. So that's why this explanation over here has ramifications. The other thing that is to note over here is that the Gemara is calling the area of the calf the shok or the shoka, which is also influential halachically because we have a principle in the Gemara, shok b'isha erva, that the shok of a woman is an erva. Question is, what is shok? Does shok mean the thigh, or does the shok mean the calf? And that obviously has influence as to how far the woman needs to cover of her leg in order to be in compliance with shok b'isha erva. So many Rishonim point out that the shok is a reference to the thigh, not to the calf, even though in an animal, when you look at the breakdown of the bones, the shok would match up in the human being as being the area between the knee and the ankle. Nevertheless, the Rabbeinu Tam says you can't compare humans and animals. They have different names of the bones, and it's just because it's called a shok in an animal doesn't mean it's called a shok in a human being. But in this Gemara, it makes it sound like the area between the ankle and the knee is called the shok. And obviously, again, that would have nafkaminot with regards to the statement of shok b'isha erva. All right, next Mishnah. Demei yadi alai, the value of my arm, I'm going to give to the Mikdash. Shamino to kamahu shaveh biyad ubelo yad. We assess how much he's worked with an arm and without an arm. Or in our case, yad, we saw before, whatever the definition is of yad by Lashon B'nai Adam, which we said is either up until the elbow, until the shoulder, depending on Rashi or Tosafot. So then you would say, how much is he worth with it? How much is he worth without it? That's the difference between a neder and arachin, because by a neder, whatever it is that you're noder, we try to figure out the value, and you give that value to the Mikdash. By arachin, we say that if it's an aver, then it's the equivalent of saying the erech of the entire person. If it's an aver that ain't a neshama tuyabo, like the arm, then it's as if he said nothing, and he owes nothing with regards to arachin. That's why here, the nedarim are bechumrah, because you're going to pay something here. By arachin, you wouldn't pay anything in this instance. Heichi sheminen le. How do we assess what it means that he has an arm or he doesn't have an arm? What's that difference in value? So, marav omdimoto, omed shel nizakim. We assess him like you would do in the case of damage. If someone injured another party and somehow either cut off his arm or did damage to his arm, we would then assess how much damage he did by saying how much is an eved in the marketplace when you sell a slave with an arm, and how much is a slave worth when you sell it without an arm. And then that differential is the nezek that was caused. And similarly over here, that's the value that he's dedicating to the Mikdash. So Amar Abaye Midomi. How can you compare the cases? Hatam Gavra Zilo, who, over there, the guy is already diminished in value. Hacha Gavra Shviachu. Over here, the person is whole. So the way Rashi learns it over here is that if a eved that comes into the market and you're selling it without an arm on it, a person who looks at that individual says, oh my gosh, that's unusual, that looks different, that's something I can't necessarily handle, or I'm going to pay much less for that. So in the end, you pay less because of the arm that's missing. But that means if you said to him, if he had an arm, how much would you pay? Rashi claims at that point you would underestimate the total value of the individual with an arm and without an arm. That's because the person has not only lost their arm, but there's diminution in value of the individual because of the lost arm. Nothing to do with the function of the arm, nothing to do with the value of the arm. It's just because he's a person that now looks strange or is incapacitated because of that missing arm. And so therefore, the person's going to underestimate the total value of the individual. That's what Rashi claims. The Baal Tosafot say that that's not what's meant by the Gemara over here. The issue over here is that Nizakim include two factors. Nizakim include the factor of the lost function of the arm, but it also includes the diminution and value of the individual from the fact that he's now an individual without an arm, which is causes a loss in value irrespective of the value of the arm or the functional value of the arm. So he says that in a case of Nizakim, you're going to overestimate it because that's what you're trying to do, trying to figure out how much damage was done over here. When a person dedicates their value of their arm to the Mikdash, they're not talking about the diminution in value with the missing arm. They're speaking about what's the value of the arm. You're looking at an individual with an arm on him still. He's still whole. So there's no diminution in value of the person. It's just the arm. And so that's why it would not be an equivalent assessment. That's how Baal Tosafot would explain it. El Amar Abaye, Abaye makes the following suggestion. Omdim kam adam rotze liten be'eved oseh melacha b'yado achat, oseh b'shtei yadav. We figure out how much a person will pay for an eved that works with two hands versus an eved that works with one hand. Yado achat mayniu. What's an eved that works with one hand? V'idach psika. That's a case where the other arm is cut off. Hanuach. That's exactly what Rava said before. So then what did you gain by making the formulation this way? Ella yado muhtevet l'rabo rishon. The case where he sold the eved, but the original owner maintained the rights to one of his arms. So now, maintaining those rights to that arm, how much would a person pay less for that? So that way, Abaye accomplishes keeping the person with his arms on, and therefore you don't get the diminution in value, according to the Baal Tosafot, for the person having a missing arm, not to do with function, but to do with his appearance. That won't be there because he has both arms on, but it's a case where you're buying him X the function of that arm, because that function of that arm belongs to his first master. That's the way Abaye suggests you assist it. By Rava, Amdu Umad Shel Nizakim, V'amar Dmei Alai. What happens if a person did an assessment for his arm because of Nezik? Then he said, I want to give the value of my arm to the Mikdash. What's the din? Mi Amar Hamdu, Chadazimna. Do we say they already assessed the value, and so we know what it is, and he can pay that? Odilma Shani Umdana Debe Asara, Mi Umdana Debe Plata. Maybe there's a difference between the assessment that's done for Nizakim, which requires a panel of three individuals, three judges to assess the value, versus the assessment for Kodesh, which requires 10 people. That's based on the Mishnah at the beginning of Sanhedrin, where the Gemara there says that the word Kohen appears in the Parsha of assessing value 10 times. That's a miot achar miot el rabo to tell you that you need 9 people plus 1 Kohen. You need 10 people, but 9 of them don't have to be Kohenim. One has to be a Kohen in order to do the assessment. So whether that's Gzeret HaKatuv, or whether because it's a Dovar Shebikdusha, because the Eretz and the people have Kedusha associated with them, for whatever reason, by a Hekdesh, you need a larger group of individuals to make the assessment, versus Nizakim, where you just need a Beit Din to do it. So now, over here, he had the assessment of a Beit Din of 3. Will that suffice for an assessment for Hekdesh, which would require 10? Im Tim Salomar, Shaini Umdina Debe Asara Mi Umdina Debe Plata. Let us say there's a difference. An assessment by 3 is different than an assessment by 10. Amar Demei Alai. If he says my value on me, Vyamdu. And then they assessed him with 10 people. Bechazar Amar Demei Alai. And then he says it again. Mau. What do we do here? Hocha Vadai Amdu Be'asara. Do we say he got the assessment in Hekdesh? And therefore when he says, I'm doing it again, we can use the assessment we just did on him. Odilma Shabach Bene Bene. How do you know? Maybe something changed. Maybe his value went up in the interim, or the market prices changed in the interim, and you need to do a new assessment. And over here, it might be, again, in Ot Yud Aleph, in the Shita Mekubetz, that he adds in, Im Tim Salomar, Shabach de Beni Beni, that there is maybe a valuation differential in the interim, Amar de Me'alai, Velo Amdu. Chazar Amar de Me'alai, Mahu. He says, I want to give my value, or the value of my arm, to the Mikdash. They didn't assess him. Then he says it again, and now they're coming to assess him. Over here, can we do one assessment for both Nadarim? Odilma, Kaven, Debizeach, Arzen, Nadar, Tre, Zimne, Amdinale. Or maybe because he took two separate Nadarim, you have to do two separate assessments. Each Nadar requires a separate assessment to determine what it is. Vim, Tim, Salomar, if you say, Kaven, Debizeach, Arzen, Nadar, he took one neder after the next. Trey Zimne, Amdina and Leh, you have to do two separate assessments. Amar Shnei Demei Alai, Bevatachat. He says in one shot, I'm giving two times my value to the Mikdash. Mao, what's the din there? Hachavadai Bevatachat Nadar, Bevatachat Amdina Leh. He took one neder and he incorporated two values in one neder, but it happened all at once. And since it's one neder, all you need is one assessment. Odilma came into Kamar Shnei, because he said two, it's as if he said it sequentially and not bevat achat. Intim Zolomar came into Kamar Shnei, since he said two, it's as if he said it sequentially, dummy. Amdul me'alav. What happens if they happen to assess him? Nothing to do with Hekdesh, nothing to do with him taking a neder, they just happen to be assessing him for whatever reason. Mau, mi amrinan ha amid me'alav. Do we say we already assessed his value? Now when he says something, we can use that assessment that was already in place. Ha amid me'alav v'koi. He's already been assessed and we took care of it already. We can use that assessment. Odilma be'inan kavana lu'umdana. Or maybe you need intent to do a proper assessment for Hekdesh. And you didn't have that when you were doing it before, because before you're just doing it willy-nilly. Now this latter question, as the Baal Tosafot will point out, does not need to be an Imtim Salomar, because this question could stand independent of the previous Imtim Salomars in the Gemara. Even if you don't say Shnei is Kazeh Kazeh, this question could stand independently, which is when you do an assessment that wasn't an assessment for Hekdesh, could it be a good assessment for Hekdesh as well? When it says Pashut Miha Chado, for this Mishnah, at least you should be able to answer this final question. It's none. Tmei Alai Umeit. Person says, I'm dedicating my vow to Mikdash, and then he dies. Loi nu yoshim. The yoshim don't have to give it. Shein damim lemeitim. Because there's no value to someone who already passed away. And even though, as Tosafot points out, we do find that there's an assessment of an individual after death, which is in a case where you have to pay kofar. When, for instance, your shor muad killed an individual, then your chayav, the demei nizak, to pay for the pidyon of kofar nafsho. That is a gzirat ha-ketuv, the Tosafot says. That doesn't mean that there's a value to an individual after they have passed away. If a person can be valued even without being valued for Hekdesh, this guy's already valued before he died, and so why should his death have any impact on it? There's no person that's below four zuz. The minimum amount that someone would sell for on the slave market is four zuz. One shekel, below that amount would not be reasonable. So, even if the person passed away, at least he was worth four zuz beforehand. If you're telling me you can do an assessment independent of Hekdesh, then if we know the minimum value of an individual is four zuz, then that's the equivalent of an automatic assessment on every person that they reach that minimum threshold, and you should have to pay that. Gemara says, Amdu amei alav, nochit l'umdina. Demei alai, lo nochit l'umdina. It's a big difference over here where the case that we spoke about is a case where they did an assessment. Nobody asked them to do the assessment. Nobody was thinking about a neder of Hekdesh, but they did an assessment with the intent of doing an assessment. There we have a question whether that assessment is good enough to stand for the assessment of Hekdesh. What we didn't say is that when a person makes a neder and there's no assessment done, that he gets an automatic assessment. Nobody said that. We said if an assessment had been done, can you use that assessment for Hekdesh? The Mishnah is talking about a case where there was no assessment done at all. He just said, the me'alai. That does not automatically trigger an assessment, or we don't say that now there's some self-evaluation that he's worth no less than four zuz, and therefore that's at least his value. That's not the case. You have to have intent for an umdana, for an assessment, even though it may not be intended for the assessment of Hekdesh, it's an intent for assessment. And without that, it wouldn't count, and therefore this Mishnah is not necessarily a proof to tell us how we would paskin with regards to an umdana that was done, not in the context of Hekdesh. Okay, we're going to stop here with the Mishnah on the top of Chof Amud Aleph.